We are studying the book of Genesis, and I am on page 58. We're on Genesis 9. Noah and the boat has landed, and they've gotten off. And so God is starting to have a conversation with them about what comes next. Then God spoke to Noah and to his son, saying, "Now behold, I myself do establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, every beast of the earth with you, and all that comes out of the ark, even every beast of the earth." So it's interesting that God has made, reestablished his covenant not only with man, but with animals. "And I establish my covenant with you, and all flesh shall never again be cut off by the water of the flood, neither shall there again be a flood to destroy the earth." God said, "This is a sign of the covenant which I'm making between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all successive generations. I set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a sign of a covenant between me and the earth. It shall come about when I bring a cloud over the earth, and the bow shall be seen in the cloud. I will remember my covenant which is between me and you and every living creature for all flesh, and never again shall the water become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the cloud, then I will look upon it, remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh, and that is on the earth." And the Lord God said to Noah, "This is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth." So God is reestablishing covenant with mankind and with the animals, and the sign of this particular covenant is the rainbow. Now, since it never rained before, this rainbow was probably a very new experience for them. They've never seen this before, because there was no moisture of any kind between the rakia and the earth, except for the mist as far as it could rise, in order to provide the refraction necessary for the rainbow. God makes a covenant with Noah, his new steward. Remember that mankind was created as a stewardship of all that we live in. We are responsible for the earth, we're responsible for the animals, we're responsible for our neighbor. Not in that order, actually. And so the new steward is now Noah, as he did with Adam before him. God commits to Noah that he will never again destroy mankind by the flood, and it becomes a sign of the new covenant. Now the sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated. Then Noah began farming and planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine, became drunk, and uncovered himself inside his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father, and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both their shoulders, and walked backwards and covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were turned away. So they did not see their father's nakedness. And then Noah awoke from his wine. He knew what his youngest son had done to him, and he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be the Lord God, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, let him dwell in the tents of Shem, let Canaan be his servant." And Noah lived 350 years after the flood, so all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. All right, so all mankind is now descended from Noah. This particularly explains why the other lines of Adam are not memorized. So if you're a young Hebrew in, say, the time of Moses, they have no need to memorize the other lines outside of the line of a direct line of Adam, because they're all gone anyway. That's why we have this. It's one of the reasons we have this sort of frozen section that goes, you know, it's a limited view of mankind from Adam to Jesus, with all the peripheral stuff falling away from our memory or even our notice, unless it interfaces with this main line. When you talk about history, it is his story. It's the story of Jesus from Adam to the second coming and the millennial reign, and that's what this is all about. So these toledots that we have seen, we're going to see again, are the basic genealogy forward for the people that here. And the toledots are used as a mechanism for memorizing history. You teach your children the toledots, and then from the toledots you hang information. We're going to see this. We're going to read this here in a minute. So you say, during the time of so-and-so, this is what happened. That's how you remember when stuff happened, if you don't have a written history, if you're just oral. The use of talidots for this purpose has been common to all aboriginals, even today, where there are aboriginal peoples still. Their existence, their deeds, and their memories perished in the flood, people outside of this lineage. Shem's descendants became the Semites and the Asians. Ham's descendants became the Egyptians and the Africans, and Japheth's descendants became the Europeans. So all of us are descended out of those three lines. Noah gets drunk on the fruit of his new vineyards. Ham's dishonor gets revealed, and Canaan gets cursed. Again, the curse on Canaan should be seen as descriptive, not punitive. It flows naturally as a consequence of the sin, not from an angry, bitter, and vindictive God. This is called a prophetic curse. Now, we talked about this before. The Hebrew language has no past, present, and future tenses. And it has no moods like we use in English. It has nine aspects. Verbs are in form, one of nine forms. And each aspect carries a type of meaning with it. Like there's one called pool, and there's nephil, and nephal, and whatever. And what happens is based on the aspect of the verb, when you read it in the text, you know certain things about what's being communicated. And this is another example of a prophetic curse where something happens and God says, because of this, you will be cursed. The aspect, when you read and understand the aspect, he's not saying that's what I want to do to you. He's saying that's the natural consequences of what just happened. It's called a prophetic curse as opposed to a punitive curse. We go back to Genesis 3. Yeah, because of what you've done, you will have difficult childbirth. Because of what you've done, it'll be hard to raise crops. Because of what you've done, there'll be enmity between you and the animals, etc., etc. Because of what you've done, you will die. These are not God saying, I'm mad at you, I'm angry at you, and I'm just going to beat the snot out of you because it makes me happy. This is God saying, these are the natural consequences of these things. He is as aggrieved about them as we are, but they are what happens. It's what happens. So
I'm having a problem. Where does it say that Canaan did anything wrong in this?
What he's saying is, it doesn't say that Canaan did anything wrong. What he's saying is that Ham's moral breakdown will show up in Canaan, his son. It's like saying, you know, you are a terrible father. And your poor child is going to be cursed because you've brought. He's going to suffer because of that, because you have this level of bad in you that they're going to suffer for it, because they're going to learn it right from you. That's what he's saying.
Just because he put a blanket on it.
Well, all right. We'll talk about this. It takes some Hebrew understanding what goes on here, because this is not what you think it is. The term, your father's nakedness, has a specific meaning. When he says that Ham looked upon his father's nakedness, it's not just that he saw his naked father. That would have happened in the shower constantly. I'm going to read chapter 18, part of chapter 18 of Leviticus to you to make a point. Starting with verse 6. None of you shall approach any blood relative to uncover nakedness. I am the Lord. Now, what that means is you cannot have sex with anybody who is your blood relative. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father. That is the nakedness of your mother. You shall not have sex with your mother because that is your father's nakedness. That's what this means. She is your mother. You are not to uncover her nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's wife. It is your father's nakedness. So, I'll read on. The nakedness of your sister, either your father's daughter or your mother's daughter, whether born at home or born outside, the nakedness you shall not uncover. The nakedness of your son's daughter or your daughter's daughter, their nakedness you shall not uncover, for their nakedness is yours. The nakedness of your father's wife, daughter, born to your father, she is your sister, you shall not uncover her nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's sister. She is your father's blood relative. What I'm trying to tell you is that the phrase to uncover nakedness implies having sex. With so what he did, in fact, he would have had no way of knowing that, because the brothers back up with a cloak and cover this thing. He would have had no way of knowing that it happened to him, that just Ham came in and looked at him. And it wouldn't have been a big deal for Ham to have looked upon his nakedness. Yeah. The term for nakedness here, you've got to remember that these things are written by people who are sometimes afraid to say what they mean because they're trying to be decent. The term for nakedness is a rather rough term for genitalia. When he says you should not look upon your father's nakedness, he says you not should look upon your father's genitalia, but he doesn't mean the father's genitalia. He means the mother's. Okay. So the offense here is much greater than this implies unless you understand both the Hebrew culture and language. Any other questions on that?
Thanks for asking that. I would have never got that.
I didn't understand it either.
Well, it's a kind of thing that in classes people read it and this goes on by. And when someone asks the question, then you got to find a way to tell them. Okay. Noah got drunk, apparently with his wife. And he was in his tent, he and his wife, and they were passed out, probably from after having sex or whatever. And Ham goes in and does something. Okay. And then he comes out and he tells his brothers about it. The brothers have the decency to not want to dishonor their parents. So they take a blanket and they back in so that they don't look upon this. And they cover it and they walk out. There should be embedded in us, a deep-seated honor for our parents that will not want us to look upon anything about them that's corrupt or bad or whatever, but most certainly their vulnerability. We've lost a whole sense of honor in this country, but it used to be that there's always feuds between fathers and children, but where those things don't happen, people honor their parents, and they honor them in ways so as to cover their weaknesses. Okay, that's honor. So I've used the example before about when I was in high school, and I'd kind of grown into a young buck. I was doing dishes in the kitchen, and my father came in, and we started messing around. He was teasing me, and then he got to jostling with me. And he and I had opportunities in previous times to kind of wrestle since I was a kid, and he handled me quite easily. Well, I'd gone off to seminary. I was in high school. I'd been gone for 9 months at a time, and I was been there for several years. I hadn't seen much of him. And so we got to messing around in the kitchen, and before you know it, I had him backed over the stove. I mean, I had him down with his head on the stove. And as soon as I did that, I realized, ooh, this is not right. And I backed off because it's not right for me to humble my father just because I can. So I backed off. And he harumphed and I harumphed and he went on his way. And we never wrestled again because it's not right for me to humble my father. It's not decent and honorable. Now, we don't... In our culture today, we've lost a lot of that. But it used to be that the truth of the matter is you didn't humble any elderly person. If you have decency, you honored the vulnerable, whether it's the elderly or the... you have people who have certain sort of physical handicaps. And it used to be that, you sort of just didn't... You just sort of looked away from it. Now it's like... What's wrong with that kid? He's got a big head, we don't have any boundaries anymore about stuff. So what Shem and Japheth have done is demonstrate that they still have honor in their heart for their parents by covering them over.
See, I'm still having a problem with this, and I'm sorry. If you and Nancy had just finished.
Yeah.
Nakedness.
We have four children, Sam. So you know.
Or if one of your kids walked into your bedroom, hey, Dad, Mom, are y'all in there? And of course you just opened the. Ooh.
No, I'm drunk. I'm drunk. Me and my wife are drunk in the bed.
So you shut the door again, or you close the door of the tent.
Yeah. Well, that's not what he did.
Okay, then I would have walked. I said, Hey, Mom and Dad are drunk and they're naked. And
that's what the two brothers did.
Yeah, but I would have shut the tent door and then left them alone in there. But why would they say, oh, we got to go in there and come back up?
Well, all right, first of all, Sam.
I'm just trying to.
I'm going to answer your question. We are not them, and we're not who we should be. So you can't take our cultural feelings and milieu and say, this is simply what we would have done. You have to realize that they had not gotten to the place in the culture yet where that level of disrespect was common among them. Now, when Ham went in, he just didn't look in, peek, and see something and walk out. Because it says, when Noah woke up, he knew what his son had done to him. And it wasn't just peek in a door. It has to do with the phraseology. The technical term for this is pudenda. Pudenda. It has to do with female genitalia. So Ham went in there and somehow or another got involved with his mother. And it's all speculation about what all happened there, whatever. But he was in the tent, and when Noah woke up, he knew something had happened. Then Ham, not only does he leave there, you know, whatever, but he goes and brags about it to his brothers. He goes and, you know, ha, ha, ha. Shem and Japheth, their attitude is, well, first of all, my parents are entitled to go to bed with whoever they wish. I mean, whenever they wish. Secondly, I'm not here to judge them on being drunk. You got to remember that being drunk is not in all the world and in all the ages the kind of negative thing that it is sometimes here because of our hang-ups with alcohol. So looking at, sort of making fun of them because they were drunk, that's disrespectful. And then, in addition to all of that, Ham does something. It's unspecified, but it has to do with violating his mother some way or the other. And it may be just that he saw that, because he might have seen his father in the shower, but he would never. Remember about women and covering, whatever. And then he comes out of the tent and he goes and har har hars with his brother. His brother's about what he saw in there. And they're shocked. They may not be because they know Ham. But their attitude is we need to cover them up so the next servant who walks in doesn't see that also. See, Noah and his wife are drunk, so they're vulnerable there. And this, you know, one of the wives could have walked into the service room, and you know, you can't knock on a tent door. You know, I mean, but you know, you might holler out, and nobody answers. You think there's nobody home. You know, you go in. So Shem and Japheth may have just been concerned that none of their wives have seen this. Your father's nakedness refers to your mother, specifically to your mother's genitalia. And it's just, you know, the Bible says, we are a people that when we want to, if we want to write something, like if you read a book today, and you read something, they spare no words. You know, they use every vulgar word and whatever. Well, the writers of the Bible did not use vulgar words. Now, they talked about breasts, but they don't think of breasts, you know, like in Song of Solomon. They don't think about that as being evil, but they didn't use vulgar terms. You know what I'm saying? So, a lot of times when you read the scriptures, you run into buzzwords that mean things. And you have to know what they meant in that particular group. So, all I can tell you with any certainty is that Ham went into the tent and did something that was a violation concerning his mother and her genitalia. It could be as simple as he just saw it, which he should never have. I mean, you have to realize how, you know, you can turn on the TV here and now and see female genitalia, all of it. And it wasn't so long ago.
What channel are you watching? Let me write that down.
CBS. It wasn't that long ago when that wasn't even done in our own culture. And the thing is we've gotten so callous that we no longer are shocked by it so much.
When I grew up, they didn't have husband and wife in the same bed.
No, that's right. They had to, you know, the Petries had to have, the rule was for the Petries, because they were the Rob and Laura Petrie were they pushed the envelope because they were in the same bed. But they both had to have a foot on the ground. So while they were in bed, they both had to have a foot on the floor. Okay, who were those people? That was the censor's rule, okay? That was as far as that had gotten. And that was what, 1960?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Then there was something called a bundling board that was put between them.
Yeah.
Male and a female.
Yeah, yeah.
They were not married.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was, there was all kinds of barriers of honor that were part of the culture that have all disappeared. They've just fled away. And now it's kind of like who can drive it to the next shocking level. No, he's a Semite. All the Arabs are Semites.
Okay.
Ishmael's a Semite.
Okay.
Okay?
He did come from the same...
All Arabs are Semites.
Okay.
So all Asians are Semites.
Okay.
The Hamites have disappeared from the face of the earth. The Africans are still Hamites, but the Egyptians are gone. There are no Egyptians anymore. The Hamites, they're gone. The Egyptians today are Arabs who are living in Egyptian cities. And if you remember that during the time of Joseph, the Egyptian pharaohs were Semites because they were the Hyksos. They had taken over Egypt from the Egyptians and had subjugated them. And then later, the Egyptians rose up and threw the Semites out. And we're told that in the day of Moses, there was a pharaoh who didn't know Joseph. So what happens is that you have these kingdoms in Egypt, and they're Egyptian people. These are Hamite people. And they're surrounded by Semitic peoples. And at some particular point, the Hyksos, which were a particularly warlike Semitic group, who were a part of the culture, managed to rise up and gain control for some 100 years or so. They were called the Hyksos, H-Y-K-S-O-S. They were Semitic. And it was during that time that Joseph was a slave in Egypt. It shouldn't shock us as much then when we see that Pharaoh was willing to turn over the command of the country to a Semite slave because if he had been an Egyptian, that would have been a very long jump. But because he was Semite anyway, and because they were subjecting the natural Egyptians anyway, it's a much shorter jump. Now, if you remember what Joseph did, Joseph is not the poster child for democracy nor for capitalism. What Joseph did was he systematically stripped the Egyptian people, the Egyptians, of everything they owned, all their land, until they became slaves to Pharaoh. If you read the story. So that when we get to the time of the, toward the end of the plagues, of the 7 years of famine, the Egyptian people are totally subjugated by the Hyksos and their people. Now, the one group of people, there's two groups of people who are not suffer under Joseph's plan. One is, of course, his Semitic brethren, because he's providing for all of them. And the other one is the priests, because they had their own supply by law and culture. But everyone else is subject to Pharaoh, became their slave. In fact, if you read the story in Joseph, he says, they said, we have nothing left. We will become Pharaoh's slaves if he will feed us. Okay. When the Hyksos are driven out by I think it's the third kingdom or whatever, which includes the Setis and Ramses, when they're driven out, everything that relates to them is erased from the walls, chiseled away. Everything, all the steals are eliminated, all the victory battles are eliminated, so that there's very little left of the Hyksos. Now, you find stuff, because they weren't that thorough, but most of it's gone away. So by the time we get to Moses, the references to Joseph have all disappeared from history, 400 and 500 years later. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah. What that verse means is Canaan is in trouble because his father is a person without honor.
Right.
And what's going to happen is he and his generations are going to be, they're going to live less well because they lack, because they've been, they're badly, they have, their genetic moral pass-through is weak, is broken. That's what he's saying. You know, it'd be like if you were looking at, you had a neighbor next door and the parents were atrocious. And they had these, in all manners of way whatsoever, and they had these 6, 7, 8-year-old kids. You'd say, those poor kids. Those poor kids are going to have a horrible life. Because look what they're learning. Look what they're seeing. you see what I'm saying? That's the sense of this. It's prophetic curse, not a punitive curse. A prophetic curse means that he is prophesying that these people will be accursed because of the actions and behaviors of, as opposed to saying, I, God, want them to be cursed. God did not want for us to die. He did not want for women to have difficult childbirth. He did not want for men to have difficult time raising crops. He did not want enmity between us and the animals. He didn't want the animals dead at all,
right,
except by sacrifice. And when we get to the millennial kingdom, all of that will be true. All that will be recovered.
Yeah.
I'm going to move on unless somebody else is wanting to belabor this more. Even flawed leaders deserve respect. Moses was flawed, but Miriam was punished for her disrespect in Numbers 12. Y'all know this, remember the story of Miriam, Moses? You know, Miriam was Moses' older sister and used to diaper his butt, as we would say in our home. My aunts used to tell me, I used to diaper your butt, boy. Which I was glad to hear at age 14. So she was Moses' older sister. Remember, she was the one who tracked him down through the water, ran up to Pharaoh's daughter, said, I can get you a nursemaid and whatever. For him, a nanny for him and whatever. And when Moses came and delivered Israel, Miriam and Aaron became persona because they were directly connected to Moses' family, and they became leaders, some by designation, some just because that's the way it works. And Miriam was powerful woman in terms of influence in that culture, given that culture and whatever. And we got to a place where Miriam began to question the fact that Moses had married a Cushite woman. And we haven't gotten to Sinai yet, or we're at Sinai, but we haven't gotten to the Ten Commandments and all the laws yet. But just genetic prejudice is such that Miriam thinks that Moses should marry a Hebrew, but he's married this Cushite woman. And so she begins to complain among the women, among the people, that Moses is not, he's taken too much upon himself as a leader of this place. Because after all, look, he's married this Cushite woman, which is not proper. In fact, it would later be forbidden, but it was not proper. And she begins to grumble with him. She says, you know, we have leadership too, and Moses has become too big for his britches. And so God calls a meeting in the tent of meeting. This is before the tabernacle got built. And they go to the tent of meeting, and he calls Miriam and Aaron and Moses to the tent of meeting. And then the cloud comes down and covers it. That was the Shekinah glory comes in. That's when they knew God was meeting with Moses, whoever was in the tent of meeting, sometimes the 70 leaders and whatever. And when that happened, the people would all go and stand in the doorway of their tent to honor it, to watch it. It was a command performance. Well, when they got into the tent of meeting, God says to Miriam, when I want to speak to a prophet, I speak to him in his dreams. I speak to him in his dream. But when I want to speak to my friend Moses, I speak to him face to face. So how was it that you were unafraid to criticize my prophet, my man? I'm quite capable of managing my own man, Miriam. I don't need you criticizing him in front of the people, stirring up trouble, stirring up anarchy, whatever. So he gives her leprosy, which makes her unclean. She has to live outside the camp. She's separated from the people. Well, Moses does what Moses always does. He goes on his face before the Lord and he begs mercy for her and asks God to please forgive her. And God says something on the order of, some people have done something like this, we would have executed them. So at the very least, she has to take this on for a month. To challenge an authority in this kind of culture is to invite execution, right? So, I mean, believe me, if you any in this world, even newer than that, if someone goes out and starts a rumor against the king, you may never see them again. Except at the public hanging, you know. So, at any rate, today we just send the CIA in to take them out. God says she's got to accept this for a month. So, Miriam has to go outside the camp and live. She has to be unclean, which is publicly humiliating, and not a lot of fun, by the way. The whole of Israel stops and waits for Miriam to get well. As Moses is leading. So they pray for her and whatever, and a month later, the leprosy goes away and she is restored into the fold of Israel. She can now walk among the people, and she still has leadership roles, but somewhat humbled, I would think, by this. So the point is that all leaders, whoever they are flawed. By definition, they're all flawed. My parents were flawed. I could tell you, I have reference things. My mother's an alcoholic. You know, my father, all kinds of things. But I am called to honor them in spite of all their flaws. I can protect myself from their flaws and stuff, which I've had to do. But it is wrong for me to go around and trash my parents and their flaws, you know, as if, you know, business, whatever. I can speak about my parents' flaws, but in an honoring way. You know what I'm saying? So I am required to honor my parents in spite of their flaws. And so is everybody who wants to walk with the Lord. It's just part of what walking with God means. So there are no perfect parents. There's no perfect leaders or whatever. One way we might put it in our country is we have to be respectful of the office, even if we're not respectful of the man, or if we don't like the man. You know what I'm saying? How many of y'all saw Band of Brothers? Gosh, is that all? Band of Brothers is one of the...
I've listened to their albums.
Yeah. Band of Brothers is one. It's about a 9 or 10 DVR set. It was built by Tom Hanks, Schindler's List guy. Who's that guy?
Spielberg,
yeah. Spielberg, remember Tom Hanks got all patriotic at one particular point after that Saving Private Ryan? And he got all involved in this, and he built this incredible series with Steven Spielberg called Band of Brothers, and it traces an actual living group of people, E Company, from Georgia all the way to the end of the war. And there's all these episodes in it, and during the episodes, you see the episode, and then the actual men who were there comment on it afterwards. You know, these are actors playing them, but they comment on it and whatever. And it's an incredible, incredible series. Well, in this series, there was a guy, David Schwimmer, played a training major or captain, whatever, here at, it's where Currahee is, here in Georgia. It's at a base. And they have a little mountain there called Currahee, and they have to run up and down this thing, whatever. Anyway, he's the training captain in charge of all of this. And he's kind of a hard fellow, not always that, he's whatever, and he's giving them a lot of trouble, whatever. But he's supposed to, because he's head of all their training and whatever. But he is a man who has a great deal of zeal for what he does, but not a lot of wisdom. And what happens is that... He does a pretty good job of breaking people down, but doesn't know much about how to put them back together again. Well, there's one scene in which there's an exercise. They're having war games, and he and his men are one group, and there's men, and he is supposed to be leading them, and he can't read the maps. He doesn't have. He's confused about where they are. His men know where they are, but he's whatever. So he's. He's just not good at certain things, but he's good at what he does. So what happens is they get to a place where they get ready to deploy, and David Schwimmer thinks that he is going to be the captain over these men because he trained them. That's traditional. And the boss calls him in and says, you know, you do an admirable job of training. We can't afford to lose you in that role. So we're going to keep you on as training, and we're going to make one of these other men the captain of this thing. Well, he knows that he's being stepped over. He knows that they've been nice about it, but he knows what this means. They have no confidence in him. So the men all rally around the new guy, and there's a real guy, I forget his name right now. They rally around him, and then they all through the war, they go along, and he gets moved up until he's a general. And this is a real live human being. This is a guy who they trace his life after the war and everything. So later in the show, what happens is they're deploying in Germany, and Schwimmer happens to come through where these men are. And everybody who sees him, all of the guys who were grunts under him, whatever, they go, there's Schwimmer, you know, whatever. They don't have a lot for him. And when Schwimmer walks up, out of the door comes this general, the guy who used to be his grunt, his general. And Swimmer looks at him, and he's supposed to salute him, but he just can't bring himself to do it. And the guy who's the general, who, you know, could have had him up on charges, whatever, he said, "We salute the office, not the person." And so Swimmer says, and moves on. And that is one of many gems in that particular movie. We salute the office, not the person. If you want to have an organized, honorable society, you have to salute, you have to obey the policeman. And he may be a total jerk. I mean, he might be a Democrat. You know, he might be for Alabama, you know, whatever. But that doesn't mean we don't have to obey him as if he were the law. There's no justification for it. But yes, it was widely used. Because the Hamites were Egyptians and Africans, and because of this curse thing, there were people who were justifying slavery by saying that it was God's will that they had to be servants of Shemites. But however, all the people who said that were Japhethites. I mean, we're all Japhethites. So, but they bent the scripture to use that as a justification for enslaving Africans. Yes, they did. And they did it for a long time in churches, from the pulpits, and in the culture.
Well,
yes.
Along that line, why do you think scripture never just comes right out and says...
Well, actually, the scripture doesn't say you're not supposed to own another person. Slavery is widely accepted in both Old and New Testaments.
That's what I thought. But it seems like that your other statement just then was that it was incorrect.
I said their justification for their slavery was that from that scripture. It doesn't come from that.
Okay.
Now, there's a couple things. First of all, we talked about this before. Slavery in the Bible is almost never chattel slavery.
Yeah.
The only people who were in chattel slavery were people condemned to the salt mines and the galley ships. All the rest of them were indentured servants. They were like the people who came over from Europe,
yeah,
who gave 7 years. All slavery had a timeline, mm-hmm, after which it was over, at the end of which you had to give them money to get started. All slavery did. You could not enslave another Hebrew for more than 7 years. At 7 years, you had to let him go. And that was true of all slaves, unless they wanted to stay. So, like, for instance, if I become enslaved to you because I've lost my farm in a bad poker game or whatever, and the only way for me to survive is we go to work for you, commit to you 7 years of labor, after which you agree to give me some money and I get to start over, something like that. Or maybe I get my property back or whatever. At the end of, and when I go and become your slave, what happens is while I'm there, I meet Nancy. She's also one of your slaves. And I decide that I want to get married, we have some kids. Okay. What happens is at the end of 7 years, I can leave, but she can't because I'm indentured and she's not. She belongs there. So what happens is that many people would decide to stay in slavery, either A, because they liked the job and the master was good and the fee was good, whatever. Eleazar of Damascus was Abraham's voluntary servant for all the days of his life. In fact, Abraham offered to God to make Eleazar of Damascus his heir. B, because they wanted to keep together with their family and all that sort of thing. Now, if you look at the story that we've been through, or we haven't gone through this in this class, but we did the story of Jacob. Jacob goes over to Haran, and there he runs into Laban, his uncle. And what happens is Laban has these daughters. He has this beautiful Rachel and this not-so-beautiful Leah, the older daughter. Well, what happens is, you know the story real quickly, I haven't got time, but he winds up marrying Rachel and Leah and then the two other maids. And he's got, at this point, 11 children. And he's had an agreement, a covenant with Laban over which flocks are his and which ones or whatever. And after 20 years of being enslaved to Laban, because that's what it is, Laban is the head of the tribe. He was trying to avoid being enslaved by Esau, and he winds up being enslaved by Laban for 20 years. After 20 years, he realizes it's time to go. He's got to leave. Well, he can leave, but he can't take anything with him. And so he goes to his wives and he says, "I've got to leave. Your father has cheated me over and over and over again. He's cheated you. And I've got to leave. I want you to go with me voluntarily." And they said to him, "Our father used us like bargaining chips. He never cared about us. And so we have no obligation to him in that regard. As far as the children goes, they belong to us. And as far as the flocks goes, they're our inheritance. So we will go with you, with the children, with the flocks. Jacob can't leave there if they don't agree to that. Once Laban catches up to them, he tells them, the flocks are mine, the children are mine, and the wives are mine. And he is legally correct. But, he said, because God appeared to me in a dream last night and told me I've been in mind my P's and Q's, we'll just agree to disagree on this, and we'll put a covenant between us. If you ever marry anybody else or mistreat my children, whatever, may God kill you. We'll agree to that. So the point is that slavery in Old and New Testaments was almost always involuntary indentured servitude. When Paul is dealing with servants, slaves, he tells them not to seek to be free just because they become Christians. He tells them to serve well, do it well. Jesus tells people to whatever state they're in to do it very, very well. So they don't look at slavery. First of all, they're not looking at antebellum chattel slavery.
Yeah.
Now, at the same time, we have the same Bible telling us you cannot mistreat aliens. You have to treat your aliens the same as you would everybody else. It says that all aliens have to obey your law, but it says you cannot mistreat them. So to take a person who is a chattel slave is a violation of mistreatment of aliens, and because it's not voluntary, that would be a violation as well. But see, we see the word slavery, and we just assume slavery is slavery. At the time of Paul, one-third of all the people in the empire were slaves. One-third of all the people were manumitted slaves. They had been slaves, but they had bought themselves free. And one-third were freeborn. Among noted slaves down through history were Aristotle, Socrates, Plato, those kind of people. They were all slaves. There are many, many captured people in this country. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think about the girls who have been brought in from as sex slaves and whatever, there's that. But you don't have to really go that far. Like you said, there are people. One of the tricks of the modern era was with the coal miners, for instance. What happened was that you would pay them in company scrip. Then you would have the only company store. They had to buy from the company store. They couldn't afford everything they needed, so they would run a tab. And before you knew it, they could not afford to leave because they were too far in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me because I can't go. Yeah. I owe my soul to the company store. That's 1920. That's when Samuel L. Lewis or Jackson or whoever it was that started the Mine Workers Union. There are individual families where somebody in the family just dominates everybody else.
Yeah.
So here in the land of the free and the home of the brave. And then you get outside the Judeo-Christian culture, and it's not even, it's just automatic. Any other comments here? I think we read like four scriptures today. That's okay. Let me just a couple quick comments. Even flawed leaders deserve respect. Moses was flawed, but Miriam was punished for her disrespect. Numbers 12. Sarai honored Abraham, even though his actions got her kidnapped in Egypt. Sarai called him Lord. She called him the honorific. My Lord, my Master, even though his actions got her captured as a slave in Egypt. It was God got her out, not Abraham. Shem's respect will pass down to his offspring. Japheth's offspring will be beneficiaries of Shem's grace. And Ham will be cursed because of his disrespect, not in a punitive way, but because if you got that kind of stuff in you, it's going to show up in all kinds of bad things. Another quick example is, if there was an Ebola outbreak in some small town somewhere, and we didn't have any way to treat it, what we would do is put the army around it and tell everybody they couldn't leave until it was either went away or everybody died. It's called quarantine. It's been done in among humans for eternity. It was the only way they stopped the bubonic plague. It's the only way they stopped the Spanish flu. It's the only way they stopped the Black Death. Then you have antibiotics and those kind of things. Quarantine, we do the same thing. I have a friend, forget who it is, somebody I know, that when they were, I know who it is, it's Bruce Burstead. When he was a kid, he got something, and the people in town didn't know what it was, and he and his entire family had to live on an empty floor in the hospital for 6 months. Couldn't go anywhere, because what this was so threatening they couldn't let it out in the community. They might not. The family might not have stayed 6 months, but they had stayed there for a long time. The family. Quarantine is the way that you prevent species destroying things from getting to everybody else. What happens is that if y'all saw the movie Outbreak, if you got everybody quarantined inside this little Colorado town, and 20% of the people have this thing, the other 80% of the people do not yet have it, but they're going to die from it because they're not allowed to leave. What's going to happen is it's going to eventually kill them all. So you're condemning those 80% of the people to death by refusing to let them out of the town. So what their parents have gets passed down to them because of that relationship. They happen to be there. They were visiting for the weekend. So, you know, cursed be those people because their parents have Ebola. And we consider that to be morally right in order to save the species. Quarantine. One of the basic medical principles. Is that right, Doc?
It is.
Okay.
Look at the tuberculosis at the beginning of the 19th century.
Yeah.
They were all quarantined.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was kind of like, there was a time when if you had tuberculosis, you were kind of considered dirty because you were going to infect, you were considered kind of a dirty person. And some people, the people who didn't know, they would say, well, they must live wrong. That's why they got that. Somebody play us, pray us out.